loved. Now what? Nud smiled.
What next, your majesties?
Nud asked.
How soon will you be leaving? Asked King Bajani.
There's nothing keeping us, said Nud.
Except giving Rocky a few minutes to digest his food, said Aynan. Everyone's attention was distracted by shouts from forward and starboard. Seagrin and Ranvege ran up and quickly returned.
One of the scout boats is returning, said Seagrin. They have news from upriver, said Ranvege.
Bring the scout captain here as soon as he's on board, said Bajani.
A few minutes later, a clean-shaven Biffalander, dressed like a prosperous Daran farmer, stepped in front of the king and queen where they'd resumed their seats on their folding thrones.
Welcome back, Scavender, said the king.
Good to be back, Bajani. You won't believe what we saw.
Scavender sat on one of the benches the girls had vacated.
Cut the dramatics, said Signy. What did you see?
Two Occident's province legions and their wizards are marching down the east bank of the Brynavon.
The king and queen both raised their eyebrows.
Do you have anything to say about this information? Queen Signy asked Nod.
It's news to me, your majesty.
Really? Said the queen. Yet you wanted us to attack Rhys instead of an understrength Nova Eberacum garrison?
The quarrel between Darren and Tamloch is a lot older than our disagreement with the Roma, said Nod.
True, said the queen, and our warriors have always wanted to test their mettle against Roma legions.
Her voice trailed off.
There's more, now that I can get a word in, said Scavender.
What?
Asked Signy, her hand back on her cheek. Scavender grinned, showing a predatory smile that marked him as anything but a farmer.
I've got a present for you, he said.
A present? Asked Queen Signy. What kind of present?
One I'm sure you'll appreciate, said the scout captain. We've captured a spy.
Chapter 30 Dario Hendin knocked on the door to the king's study.
Jennet is here, my liege.
About time,
came Dario's voice through the door's thick timber. The door opened, and the young king stuck his shaved head out.
There you are,
he said, looking at the young woman in the wine-coloured dress and leering.
I've got plans for you.
Dario took Jennet's hand and pulled her inside. See that we're not disturbed, he said, with a wink for Hendin and the other guards. The door was pulled closed with a loud thunk, and everyone in the antechamber could hear a heavy bolt being thrown. Hendin and the members of his squad grinned at each other. The young king was the young king, after all. On the other side of the door, Dario gave Jennet a hug, then stepped back, keeping his hands on her shoulders. You know what to do, he asked.
Stall as long as possible, Jennet replied. It won't be a problem for you. I can pretend to sigh and moan and say, Oh, Dario, for several hours, if that's what you mean.
Great, said Dario. I'd appreciate as long a head start as you can give me.
Trust me, I'll be convincing, said Jennet. I'd rather come with you, and I'd rather have your company, but I need you for your skills at misdirection. You could summon my sister too. She could provide misdirection, and I could watch your back.
Imagine how the guards would gossip if I was alone with both of you for several hours, said Dario.
Especially with constant cries of, Oh, Dario, coming through the door, said Jennet with a grin. My sister is quite good at imitating my voice, by the way.
I'm sure she is, said the young king, rolling his eyes and making Jennet laugh.
Stop it, she said. Why do you have to pretend to be such a pig in public? You know why.
I do, said Jennet, frowning.
It's so your mother won't drug you into compliance. Far better for her to think you're a fool caught up in his passions.
You won't give me away, will you?
Asked Dario, smiling and raising his eyebrows.
Not if you kiss me, said Jennet.
Dario did, enthusiastically. Reluctantly, Jennet moved a few inches back after 24 rapid heartbeats. She smiled at Dario.
And if you take me with you next time, said the young king, I need to leave now, so I'm not gone too long. I don't want Mother to get suspicious. If you're not back in a few hours, I'll tell her that you wore me out and I fell asleep. When I woke up, you were gone, said Jennet.
She fluttered her eyelashes and gave a convincing imitation of a noble's crown-chasing daughter, new to court and in awe of the queen.
Let's hope I'm back soon enough that you won't need to lie to my mother. If you're back soon enough, you can wear me out before you unbolt the door.
Janet shrugged, and her wine-coloured dress fell to the floor, revealing only Janet beneath.
That's sufficient incentive to encourage an early return, said Daria. Maybe I won't need to ask your sister to join us with that inspiration.
Janet moved close to Daria again. He could feel her soft skin in his arms and warm breath on his neck.
Blast, he said, stepping back. You don't play fair.
Knight takes Queen's advisor, said Janet, as she bent to pick up her dress and pull it over her head. Check. Dario took off his clothes while Janet admired his well-muscled form. He crossed to his desk and removed travelling clothes more suitable to a poor merchant than a rich monarch from the bottom drawer of his desk.
Let me help you put those on, said Janet.
I don't think so, said Dario. I can only handle so much temptation at one time. Janet bared a shoulder, revealing her breast momentarily, and laughed.
I promise to behave, she said, and it will go faster if I assist.
Go ahead, then, said Dario. Between the two of them, Dario was promptly dressed in loose-fitting breeches, a patched linen shirt, a quilted jacket, hose and well-worn boots.
Don't forget this, said Janet,
putting a dark-haired wig on Dario's head and topping it with a floppy blue hat.
Do I look anything like a king? He asked.
Not a bit, Janet answered. Should I put a sprig of holly in your cap so you look like a farm lad on his wonder year?
Do you have one?
No, but I'll try to remember for next time.
Please do, said Dario. No one expects much from hayseeds on their wonder years.
Don't be an ass, said Janet.
Just staying in practice, said Dario.
As if remembering something he'd almost forgotten, he returned a book that had been open on his desk to an empty spot on a bookshelf. That accomplished, he gave Janet a hug and a peck on the cheek, then passed through the curtain hiding the servants' alcove and out of the royal suite. Janet picked up the fine clothes Dario had been wearing and arranged them artfully on the floor around the huge overstuffed couch pressed against one wall of the king's study. With luck, their placement would support the king's deception. They'd served that purpose well many times before, thought Janet. She walked halfway around the room to a wall holding built-in floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. Janet examined Dario's extensive collection and noted the title of the book he'd just returned. Its subject didn't appeal to her, so she selected a thick volume on the Roma invasion of the Abernoth. Taking a seat on a comfortable chair next to the Sharmat boards with the book on her lap, Janet considered Dario's likely move to escape check so she could properly counter it. Every so often she'd touch herself for inspiration and say, "Oh, Dario," loud enough for the guards to hear her. She hoped the king had a productive trip and made a speedy return. He was always so energized when he came back from his excursions outside the palace. Dario left the palace through the merchant's gate, carrying four flat empty wicker baskets arrayed in tiers and slung from a leather harness behind him. They were the sort of baskets used for fresh strawberries, berries that were only available this early in spring in the southern reaches of Dharan. He made his way through the city, admiring the vibrant life of Brendinus and the colourful language of its inhabitants. That language, and its vocabulary, grew even more colourful as he reached the docks. Dario filed away a few new insults to use for his private musing about his mother, and found the narrow courier boat he was looking for along a short pier far from the royal docks. He nodded to the woman wearing mail and carrying a spear who'd been guarding the vessel, and claimed a soft blue velvet pouch that he'd left with her for safekeeping. After first removing the wicker baskets and harness and placing them amidships, Dario carefully climbed into the boat near the prow and positioned himself on a thwart. He found a sturdy wooden pole at his feet and inserted it into a slot designed to hold it. Then he opened the velvet pouch, removed the pull stone and cord within, and hung it from the pole. He leaned back, triggered the pull stone with a phrase, and reached below the thwart for an oar to help guide the vessel's course as it sped down the Brenhaven. This was no ordinary pull stone. It was a royal courier pull stone Dario had borrowed to assist with his surreptitious explorations of his kingdom. Dario felt like he was skimming along the river as fast as a wizard zooming by above on a flying disc. The Vifalander's fleet couldn't be far. Dario needed to see its strength for himself if he was going to make good decisions as a battlefield commander. He sped south until he saw hundreds of square-sailed ships filling the river ahead. His attention was completely focused on the Bifaland Armada, so he didn't notice another larger boat hiding behind the roots of a downed tree hung up on a sandbar near his course. Grappling hooks bit into the stern of Dario's courier boat, and its speed didn't do him any good when the other boat hauled his in.
"What do we have here?"
asked one of the sailors from the larger boat, a woman with gold hoop earrings.
"A present for the Queen," said Scavander,
the larger boat's scout captain. His look reminded Dario of one of the feral wolf dogs in the royal menagerie.
"And a very fast pullstone," said Hoop Earrings.
"Aye," said Scavender. "Too fast for a merchant, but perfect for another profession I can think of."
Hoop Earrings and other crew members laughed.
"I should have stayed in Brendinas with Jennet," thought Dario. "Blast!"
His captors trussed him up with anchor rope and dumped him in the bilge water at the bottom of their vessel while they tied his courier boat to its side and floated with the current south to the Bifaland fleet. Chapter 31 Merry Astri and Merry entered the assembly hall through a side door and found themselves trapped in a crowd of wizards, stuck between their shields and the walls. Dothan was standing in front of a platform on the left, and a big wizard in striped robes was opposite him on the right.
"Hiblick always was a bully," said Astri.
"Dothan, look out!"
shouted Merry, clutching Astri's arm. She wanted to help her friend and mentor, but was stuck on the outside looking in. Hiblick shot a dozen cubes of solidified sound ahead of him as he leaned forward and lumbered toward Dothan on the far side of the Conclave's assembly hall. The big man looked more like a knight's charger than a knight in his bulky, magically generated armor. His fists were similar cubes, ready to deliver massive blows to his opponent. Dothan pulled his flying disc off his back and didn't take time to mount it. He held it in both hands and flew above Hiblig's cubical missiles, floating near the domed ceiling of the hall. The inertia of Hiblig's forward motion slammed him into the bottom of the platform and stood him up. He shook his head to clear it and turned to search for Dothan, scanning the floor of the hall. But Dothan was overhead, not on the floor. He managed to stand on his flying disc during the brief interval when Hiblick was disoriented. Dothan banked a heavy ball of solidified sound off the shields above the platform, so it hit Hiblick in the back of the head and knocked him down and forward. The big man was as awkward as a tortoise for a moment, his bulky magical armor making it hard for him to get back on his feet. Force beams of tight light pulsed from Dothan's hands toward Hiblig's neck, rocking Hiblig's head against the fitted stone floor a dozen times before he could strengthen his shields.
"You'll be sorry for that,"
shouted Hiblick as he stood and glared up at Dothan.
"I'm already sorry we're wasting time on this," Dothan replied softly.
The hall was quiet enough that all the assembled wizards had no trouble hearing him. Hiblick shocked Merry by immediately launching a fireball at Dothan. The older wizard dodged, but the fireball hit the shielded ceiling above him and exploded. The shockwave it generated flipped Dothan upside down. His boots stuck through leather straps were the only things connecting him to his disc. Pressure from the wave also pushed Dothan down into Hiblig's reach. The big man rushed forward from his position in front of the platform and hit Dothan's dangling head with an oversized fist of solidified sound bigger than a maul. The older wizard interposed a shield before the blow hit, but its impact still spun him around six times and sent him hurtling against the shields of the observing wizards opposite the platform. Dothan bounced off their hard surface and continued to hang suspended upside down. He was stunned and shook his head to clear it as his flying disc slowly descended. Several nearby crown wizards in solid-coloured robes wanted to help, and so did many of the free wizards, but long-standing custom prevented them from taking action.
"If Hiblick tries to kill Dothan, I won't care about custom," thought Merry.
Her hands clenched into fists, but she tried to stay calm. She'd never thought her introduction to the Conclave would include a literal battle for leadership. Hiblick hadn't paused in his attack. It wasn't in his nature to give Dothan time to recover. The big wizard in bigger magical armor rushed across the assembly hall like a stampeding wizard and bashed Dothan against the wall of shields. Dothan's flying disc was 9 or 10 feet above the floor, which meant his head was hanging at exactly the right level for Hiblig to hit it with his augmented fists. The leader of Princess Gwynnett's faction threw the first of what was intended to be a series of punches, but Dothan's head was no longer there. Instead, the older wizard, still dangling upside down below his flying disc, was back near the ornate domed ceiling. Hiblig made quick modifications to the legs of his magical armour and leapt like a giant locust toward his foe. Merry was pleased to see that tactic must have been just what Dothan had been waiting for. Force beams of tight light sped from his fingertips and struck Hiblig's left hip and shoulder. The big wizard began to spin as he ascended. Dothan continued to use force beams to accelerate Hiblig's rotation. Hiblig extended his arms to slow his motion, but Dothan, still inverted, targeted his wrists and hands, using them as levers to make Hiblig spin even faster.
Yes! Merry shouted, as the big wizard's motion became a blur. That's got to make him dizzy.
Astrid put a cautionary hand on Merry's arm.
I get it, thought Merry. The duel isn't over.
And it wasn't. Hiblig dispelled his massive armour and pulled himself into a tight ball inside a protective sphere of solidified sound, negating much of his rotation. As the big wizard fell to the floor, Dothan righted himself on his flying disc and circled the hall, seeking a spot far from where his opponent would land. Hiblig rolled his sphere half a dozen times to soak up momentum, then stood facing Dothan.
"Nice trick," said the big wizard. "Too bad you won't live long enough to benefit from it."
Merry heard several wizards near her inhale sharply. Some wore striped robes, not just solid-coloured ones.
Astrid whispered, "Hiblig's crossed the line now. Duels for leadership aren't supposed to be to the death. They're tests of skill."
"Let's get this over with," said Dothan. Merry thought he seemed tired. "Wouldn't you be?" she considered. Hiblig balled his hands into fists, bent his elbows, held his arms in front of him, and moved one of his forearms around the other as if winding rope on a torsion catapult. Merry didn't know what Hiblig intended, but she hoped Dothan didn't give him time to find out.
"Watch," whispered Astrid.
Dothan used his wizardry to open a tiny congruency near Hiblig. It was so small, hardly anyone saw it, but Merry did. She remembered her friend and first mentor had an entertaining way of keeping unwanted guests away from his tower. Then she smiled as a deafening chorus of barking hounds, supplemented by the clanks of cocking crossbows, filled the room. Merry knew what came next. The hounds were just a distraction.
"Call off your dogs! They won't save you," said Hiblig.
Merry thought his voice sounded more like a mountain cat snarl than human speech. Hiblig stopped moving his forearms and slapped at the side of his head.
"As you wish," said Dothan.
The baying hounds and soldiers with crossbows went silent. Thanks to the excellent acoustics in the hall, every wizard assembled there could hear the annoying whine of a single midge flitting around Hiblig's left ear. Merry's laugh joined the midge's whine.
"He's put the congruency in Hiblig's ear canal."
Eyes turned to stare at her, and Merry moved behind Astrid's dark blue robes to be less visible. Hiblig was slapping at both ears now.
"Dothan generated a second congruency."
One midge was joined by 10 more, then 100, then 1,000, then 10,000 gathered in a dark cloud around Hiblig's head. More wizards around the assembly hall started to laugh. Hiblig's face turned red, and Merry could see he considered opening his mouth but thought better of it, deciding he didn't want to inhale midges. The tiny flyer's wingbeats changed from a thin whine to a loud hum, reminding Merry of an unhappy hive of bees. Hiblig made a gesture, then reluctantly lowered his jaw and spoke a trigger word. His suit of solidified sound armour formed around him, but it didn't help. The congruencies linked to marshes filled with midges were inside his ears, not outside his armour.
"I wonder how far south Dothan had to reach to get midges," wondered Merry. "It'll be another month until they're a problem on the Ruthro."
In the middle of the assembly hall, Hiblig was looking more and more frantic. His face under his transparent solidified sand helmet was speckled with black dots.
He was crouching in the centre of the hall and tossing small fireballs at his own head, trying ineffectually to eliminate the midges. Dothan descended and stood in his original position on the platform with his flying disc strapped to his back. Still more wizards were laughing at Hiblick, and others were applauding Dothan's cleverness.
"Thank goodness the duel's over," thought Mary.
But it wasn't. Hiblick bellowed Dothan's name and erupted from his crouch, charging toward the older wizard on the raised platform. 10 quick steps and a small jump put Hiblick beside his opponent. He locked Dothan in a bear hug and used a much bigger jump to carry them both to the center of the hall. Dothan had gotten his own body shield up in time, but Hiblick still held him by the neck in his left hand while he pummeled him with hammer-like blows with his right. Dothan's shield started to waver from transmitted impacts, and Hiblick added a long triangular blade to the armor on his right fist.
"No!"
shouted Mary. She didn't know how to get around the other wizard's shields, but she had to do something to save her friend. Astri held Mary's shoulders, and they both watched in horror as Hiblig's arm moved back, ready to administer a killing blow. All eyes were on Dothan and Hiblick. No one was breathing. Then everyone went blind. Mary blinked, trying to see again after a flash of golden light, brighter than the sun at noon, splashed out above the platform, filling the hall. She felt a chill and heard a familiar voice.
"What in the name of the first shift is going on here?"
Mary shook her head and rubbed her ears. She could make out a gleaming figure in sparkling blue robes descending on a flying disc toward Dothan and Hiblick. Something about the two combatants was different. They were literally frozen in place, held in tableau by a thick coating of ice. Without conscious agreement, the dozens of shields surrounding the assembly hall came down. Clumps of wizards buzzed with conversation like clouds of midges.
"I go away for 40 years and everything goes to pieces," muttered Damon, as he landed and adjusted the drape of his robe's beautifully decorated fabric.
Inthira stepped forward.
"Greetings, good wizard," she said. "Who are you, if you don't mind me asking?"
"I don't mind a bit. I am the Elderman, Master Mage of Darn, and I'm here to get things back on track."
Mary turned to see her companion's reaction, but Astri was gone. All eyes were on Damon, wondering what sage pronouncement the semi-mythical Master Mage of Darren would utter. Damon slapped at his ear and waved his hands in front of his face, looking annoyed. Then he spoke.
"How did all these blasted midges get in here?"
Chapter 32 Fircher. "Where did he go?" asked Fircher.
Princess Gwynnett was looking uncharacteristically like a mother, rather than a cold-blooded spider, but Fircher wasn't convinced.
"If I knew that, I wouldn't need you," said Gwynnett.
They were alone in a private chamber somewhere in Princess Gwynnett's apartments. Gwynnett was seated. Fircher had chosen to remain standing. Given the other woman's penchant for poisons, she was afraid to touch anything, and certainly wouldn't accept any offers of refreshments. She wasn't even sure about breathing, but didn't have much choice about that. She created a transparent bubble of solidified sound around her head just to play it safe.
"Yes, but why me?" asked Fircher. "Why not one of your tame wizards, like Hiblick?"
"Hiblick is more of a blunt object," said the princess. "This calls for someone with more creativity and finesse."
"And Hiblick is at the gathering of the conclave," thought Fircher, "causing trouble, no doubt. I should be there helping Dothan, not here verbally fencing with a traitor to the realm."
"When was the last time anyone saw the king?"
"Early this afternoon. He was talking to a deluded old man with a nonsensical claim of being the Master Mage of Darren, then summoned a young woman to be his Sharmad partner."
"From your tone of voice, I assume chess wasn't the only form of entertainment Dario expected."
"That's quite likely," said Gwynnett. "My son has a way with women."
Fircher nodded, but her face revealed nothing. Gwynnett thought Dario's female companions were effective tools for her to use to control her son and keep track of his actions.
"Which one was it this time?" asked Fircher.
"Jennet, Duke Hyden's eldest daughter."
"I'm not sure I know her," said Fircher,
trying to make the lie convincing.
A redhead? She has dark brown hair, said Gwynedd. Slim, small bust, wears dresses in jewel tones.
That describes a third of the young women in court, said Fletcher.
The guards tell me they found her naked under a blanket on a couch in Dario's study.
The couch? Asked Fletcher.
The infamous couch of King Dario. The one where every noble's daughter who wants to be queen has to audition.
Whatever do you mean? Asked Gwynedd.
She raised an eyebrow to make sure Fletcher knew that she was quite familiar with the rumours. She'd probably helped to spread them to ensure her son's popularity did not become so great that he'd think he could defy his mother. Fletcher knew a good many more would-be queens had claimed they had spent time on the couch than actually had.
What did this Jennet say?
That she fell asleep after she defeated Dio at a game of Charmat, and the two of them decided to take a nap.
Naked? Asked Fletcher.
How do you sleep? Asked Gwynedd.
Fletcher inclined her head and let half a smile flit over her face.
Let me guess, said Fletcher.
When she woke up hours later, Dario was gone.
Correct, said Princess Gwynedd. His clothes were on the floor next to the couch, but Dario had disappeared.
Did any servants see him leave the royal apartments?
No, but all the retainers in the alcove behind the curtain in the king's study have been dismissed. That was standard practice when Dario played Charmat.
I understand, said Fletcher. Young men value their privacy.
So do young kings, said Gwynedd. The guards started to worry when they didn't hear anything inside the study for several hours. They found one of Dario's personal servants relaxing in the kitchens after eating lunch and had him open the servants' entrance. He said he had the only key to the door and he'd left it locked.
Curious, said Fletcher.
She knew that particular servant well and might have to talk with him one-on-one. His loyalty was to Dario, not Gwynedd, though. He might or might not tell her the truth. Fletcher was sure Gwynedd also had a key to the servant's door, in addition to the main entrance to her son's study. Gwynedd was too controlling not to have keys.
Was there any blood? Fletcher asked.
You mean was Jennet a virgin? I doubt it. She's played Charmat with Dario in private before.
No, said Fletcher. I was asking whether or not there were signs Dario might have been injured when he was abducted.
Oh, said Gwynedd, without a hint of emotion.
So much for maternal concern, thought Fletcher.
Do you think he might have been kidnapped? Asked Gwynedd. I hope that's not the case. I need him back, as quickly and discreetly as possible.
For your treacherous spider plot with Tuathal, thought Fletcher.
What would you like me to do? Talk to Jennet. Talk to the servant. Talk to the guards, said Gwynedd. Do whatever you have to do, but find the king.
Fletcher considered it telling that the princess had not said, find my son.
Then again, thought Fletcher, I'm hardly a model of maternal concern myself. I wonder where Nurd and Merry's lover from the coombe went after the battle at the quarry early this morning. Maybe the skinny boy with the dried holly leaves in his cap took Nurd to his home, and they're both safely out of harm's way, weeding fields and milking cows.
Is something wrong? Asked Gwynedd.
Fletcher realized she'd been silent for several seconds. She just remembered that Merry's lover, Einan, his name was, had her original mage stone. That was yet another problem to address.
No, I'm fine, said Fletcher. I'm thinking about questions for Jennet.
Don't just think. Get moving, said Princess Gwynedd. Lost kings don't find themselves.
You may be wrong about that, thought Fletcher. Where's Jennet now? She asked.
Still in Dario's study, under guard, said Gwynedd.
I'll keep you informed, said Fletcher as she walked to the door.
See that you do, said the princess.
Fletcher had ordered the guards to leave the king's study and finished expanding a privacy sphere to include Jennet and herself.
We can't be overheard now. Where did he go?
I have no idea, said Jennet.
When I woke up, he was gone. You're going to make this difficult, aren't you?
What do you mean?
I know about the act, said Fletcher. I helped Dario design and refine it.
The guards said Princess Gwynedd sent you.
I am no more a pawn of Gwynedd's than a sparrow is a griffin, said Fletcher.
I think she asked me to help find Dario as much to keep me away from the conclave as to find your Charmat partner.
You're part of the old Queen's faction, aren't you?
Asked Jennet.
You were coming into Dario's study when I was leaving this morning. That's right, said Fircher. But I'm not just part of the Queen's faction. I help lead it, along with a few others. I thought so, said Jennet. In that case, she continued, her voice still uncertain. My only interest is in helping Dario, said Fircher. Where did he say he was going? Jennet gave Fircher a wary glance. Of course, said Fircher. He wouldn't tell you. He'd want you to be able to say you didn't know where he'd gone without needing to lie. A smile played over Jennet's face. Did you teach him that? She asked. I didn't have to, said Fircher. He figured that out on his own. Well, said Jennet, crossing to the bookshelves, he was reading this just before he left. She removed a slim volume and placed it face up in Fircher's outstretched hand. Fircher noted the title. Bifferland Naval Tactics and Strategy. She nodded, remembering a gate she'd built for an innkeeper in Brendinas, who'd inherited a second establishment in Arthavan, a small town on the west bank of the Brenavon, 20 miles downriver. With luck, she'd catch up to Dario before he reached the Bifferland fleet. As she moved to leave the king's study, Fircher glanced at the Sharmat board next to where Jennet had been sitting. Nice game, she said. Checkmate in 4 moves. 3, said Jennet. But Fircher was already gone. Chapter 33 Nud and Einan. Nud and Einan stepped away from the Bifferland royals' folding thrones and put their backs to the mainmast. A young man, a little older than Einan and a little younger than Nud, was on the deck, trussed like a goose on a spit. His head was shaved. Einan thought he looked familiar, but wasn't sure why. "Where did you find him?" asked Queen Signy. "And what makes you think he's a spy, not a merchant with headlice?"
"He had a pullstone as good as a royal courier's," said the scout captain, holding the stone in question by its thong and letting it swing. "We found him just north of the fleet. What else could he be but a spy?"
The scout captain slipped the pullstone over his head so it rested on his breastbone. He then pulled a floppy blue hat and a dark wig from his belt. Both were damp.
"He was wearing a disguise," added the scout captain,
waving the wig and hat in disgust.
"And not a very good one."
King Bajani stood and shoved the prisoner across the deck a few feet with the sole of his boot.
"What do you have to say for yourself?" he asked.
The prisoner shifted his bound body as best he could until he faced the king and queen.
"I sell strawberries from the southern provinces," he said. "That pullstone helps us get them to market in Brendinas faster. It's been in our family for generations."
"Next thing you'll be telling me that it was enchanted by the legendary Master Mage Elderman himself," sneered the scout captain,
before kicking the prisoner in the ribs.
"Scavenger,"
said the queen, holding up her hand as a note of caution. The prisoner glared at the scout captain and spit out his reply.
"Our pullstone was made for my grandfather's grandfather. It's far older than the wizard who couldn't find Princess Seren."
"Perhaps we'll chain you to an oar instead of kill you then," said Queen Signy.
Sigrun and Ranvegir had moved to stand beside Signy.
"Please don't kill him," pleaded Sigrun. "I like the way his head looks like an egg."
"I think he's cute," said Ranvegir.
Both girls giggled.
"Cute or not," said Queen Signy, smiling at the girls indulgently. "He rows or he dies."
Sigrun and Ranvegir gave the queen a look that Einan knew how to translate. He'd seen the same look from his sister plenty of times, usually accompanied by, "Oh, Mom!" The stakes weren't usually as high as a man's life, however. Nud and Einan exchanged glances. Einan put his hand on his red mage stone. Nud nodded and stepped forward.
"He'll be coming with us, your majesties. We'll see that he's returned to his family."
"Along with my pullstone," said the prisoner.
"Don't push your luck," said King Bajani. "It's Scavenger's now."
"He's a thief," said the prisoner.
"And you're a spy," said the scout captain.
Einan turned to Nud, his expression asking, "Who does this fool think he is?" Queen Signy laughed. So did King Bajani.
"You've got spirit, lad," said the king. "I like that. Care to fight him for the stone, Scavenger?"
To Einan's eye,
The scout captain appeared to be 10 years older, 50 pounds heavier, and a much more experienced warrior than the prisoner. Tattoos on Scavenger's arms wove in and out of long white lines from old sword or axe wounds. A scar ran down his left cheek, ending at the corner of his mouth and giving him a menacing appearance. The only thing remotely menacing or intimidating about the prisoner was his shaved head.
"Why don't we up the stakes, sire?" asked the scout captain. "If he wins, the young wizard and his friend get the spy and his bull stone. If I win, I keep the stone and you can give me the spy as my thrall."
King Bajani turned to Queen Signy. The queen nodded.
"Very well," said Bajani. "Cut him free and give him a chance to stretch his muscles. I don't want it said that a trial in my court isn't fair."
"A trial, your majesty?" asked Nud.
"By combat, lad," said the king. "Don't you have trial by combat in Daran?"
"Not officially," said Aenon, thinking about how people would get into fights in the Seven Taverns down in Caer Caddle. Scavenger cut the prisoner free, and the young man with the shaved head rose to his feet.
"How does this work?"
asked Nud. "Yes," said the prisoner, looking at Nud and Aenon, then turning to address the king and queen. "Do I have my choice of weapons?"
"Weapons increase your odds of dying," said Queen Signy sternly. "Wouldn't you rather live as a thrall than be cut down by an experienced warrior's blade?"
The prisoner paced and rubbed his chin.
"Decisions, decisions," he said, smiling.
"You find your situation amusing?" asked the queen.
"Victory and freedom," said the prisoner, holding up one hand. "Defeat and slavery or death," he continued, holding up the other.
"Maybe he's a poet, not a spy," said Scavenger. "He sounds like a scald."
The scout captain stepped over to the prisoner and put a hand on his shoulder.
"Don't worry, lad. I won't try to kill you. I don't want to reduce your value as a slave."
The prisoner shifted out from under Scavenger's hand and took 2 steps away from the older man until he stood between the king and queen. He moved his hands up and down as if weighing his options, then spread his arms wide.
"The choice before me is clear," he said. "I'll just have to win."
Scavenger laughed. King Bajani tried to keep his face neutral but failed and broke into a smile.
"You could try," said the king. "What will it be, lad? Swords, axes, knives, bare hands?"
Aenon took a close look at Scavenger. The muscles in his right arm were larger than those in his left, like his cousin who'd served as an axeman in the levies. His cousin trained with a long-handled, double-bladed axe, which gave him asymmetrical muscles.
"I'm not clear on the rules for your trials," said Nud. "Must both parties use the same weapon?"
"Not if individual choices of weapons are otherwise acceptable," said the queen.
"You don't have my preferred weapon anyway," said the prisoner.
"Daggers in the back," teased Scavenger.
The prisoner grimaced. "Would that be your choice?"
Scavenger caught Bajani's eye.
"You're right, sire. He does have spirit." "What is your preferred weapon?" asked the king.
"You won't have one."
"Try me," said the king.
"It is a long, straight, narrow V-shaped blade with a single edge and a bell guard."
"A torn sticker," said Scavenger.
He laughed from his diaphragm.
"A weapon for those who lack the strength to wield a broadsword," said Bajani.
"I'm sure there are some below," said the queen. "We've taken them from slaves captured on raids. I'll have a few brought on deck for you to choose from."
"Thank you, your majesty," said the prisoner.
"Fetch my axe," Scavenger ordered one of his boatmates.
The prisoner went through a series of stretching exercises and calisthenics that included knee bends and lunges while they waited for their weapons. Scavenger's warm-up wasn't nearly as strenuous. He shrugged his shoulders several times and pretended to swing a heavy double-bladed axe. Aenon used the break to whisper with Nud.
"I'm not going to let Scavenger kill him," said Aenon quietly. "He's just a strawberry merchant, and he's not much older than I am."
"If we have to leave in a hurry, we'll need a distraction," said Nud.
Aenon touched his red mage stone.
"Not another fireball," Nud whispered. "If we have to go in a hurry, please try for something more subtle."
"I'll think about it," said Aenon.
Biffalanders don't favour subtlety, he thought. They're more direct.
"Will Rocky be ready to fly?"
asked Nud.
"I hope so," said Aenon.
He leaned back and looked for Chi in the rigging.
The Raconet had returned to his former position, sitting on the horizontal pole that held the sail aloft, with his back to the mainmast. Einan magically augmented his distance vision and saw that Chi was nibbling the last of his apple and watching the proceedings below with interest. Sigrun and Ranveigir followed Einan's gaze and waved to Chi. The Raconet waved back and held up his mostly consumed apple like a trophy. The sailor returning with Scavendir's axe came back first. The weapon was as tall as the scout captain, with a double-bladed steel head like two crescent moons, and steel strips reinforcing the thick length of ironwood forming its shaft. Scavendir hefted it and swung it back and forth with the ease of a child waving a twig. The scout captain showed off his skill with heavy strokes at imaginary targets, trying to intimidate the prisoner. The younger man watched with interest. Beads of perspiration formed on his shaved skull, despite the light wind on the river. Most of a minute passed before another sailor appeared, holding what Queen Signy had asked her to retrieve.
"I could only find three,"
she said, standing in front of the Queen, holding the blades across her outstretched arms like lengths of firewood.
"Ooh, pretty,"
said Sigrun, taking a blade from the sailor. Ranveigir took one too, and the two blonde-braided girls crossed them and danced across the deck, shouting with exuberant glee and enjoying the clangs as their swords crossed.
"Girls," said Queen Signy, her voice cutting through the clamour. "Don't make me send the two of you to take a turn on the oars." "Yes, mother,"
said Sigrun.
"Yes, Aunt Signy," said Ranveigir.
The girls crossed their blades one last time and delivered them to the prisoner for inspection before the ringing faded. The sailor, holding the third blade, raised her eyebrows and smiled at the queen, then did likewise. She stuck the point of the sword she held into the deck, with its bell guard swinging back and forth with the ship's motion. The prisoner stuck the swords he'd been given by the girls into the deck and tested the strength and flexibility of each blade by leaning down on them. One blade was very flexible, but it didn't spring back straight. Another wouldn't bend much at all when tested. The third blade, however, met with the prisoner's approval. He inserted his right hand into the bell guard and put his left hand over the rounded metal, gripping the light blade like a broadsword. He lifted the weapon above his head and brought it arcing down several times like he was swinging an axe to cut a tree. Scavendir and King Bajani exchanged a knowing look. Spirit on the part of the prisoner wouldn't be enough to give the scout captain much of a fight.
"Clear the deck," the king commanded.
Warrior sailors moved the benches that had been put in place for Nurd and Einan. The king and queen stood and moved their own folding thrones back a spear length, opening a square space about 15 feet from side to side and mast to thrones. Scavendir moved to port and indicated to the prisoner that he should move to starboard. Bajani and Signy sat comfortably on the repositioned thrones with Sigrun and Ranveigir close together at their feet like a pair of playful puppies. The three wizards in gold robes stood directly behind the thrones. Einan and Nud stood next to the mainmast, with Rocky farther toward the prow behind them. Members of the crew, who weren't required for safe sailing, gathered wherever they could find a good spot to watch.
"What are the rules of the trial?"
asked Nud, addressing the king and queen.
"They're simple," said Scavendir, before either monarch could answer. "When the egghead is dead or surrenders, it's over."
The scout captain grinned across the deck at his opponent, who was holding his blade down and shifting from foot to foot uncomfortably.
"So the only rule is that there aren't any rules?"
asked Nud, locking eyes with Bajani, then shifting his gaze to the queen, then back to the king.
"The trial is over when I say it's over," said Bajani. "Anyone jumping over the side will get a crossbow bolt through their chest. Any use of wizardry to aid either party is forbidden."
The king glanced at Einan, who nodded. The three women in gold robes with amber necklaces stared at Einan in a way that made it plain they'd enforce their sovereign's prohibition on magic.
"Are we ready to begin?" asked Queen Signy.
"Aye," said Scavendir.
"As I'll ever be," said the prisoner.
The queen turned in her seat and nodded to the women in gold robes. Before she could turn back, a yellow-tinted wall of solidified sound, 10 feet high, materialized in front of the thrones, protecting the king and queen. The woman in the middle of the gold-robed trio extended her hand toward Einan, who created a similar wall on his side with a pink tinge. A breeze from the river moving from port to starboard swirled dust on the deck inside their makeshift arena.
"Lay on," said King Bajani to both combatants. "And don't play with your food.
he added as an aside for his scout captain.
"I'll make it quick," said Scavender,
moving the head of his axe in front of him in a mesmerizing figure-eight pattern.
"I've got more to tell you about the Roma legions."
The scout captain and the prisoner approached each other and circled just outside the maximum reach of Scavender's axe. The prisoner held his sword at waist height, close to his body, with the blade reaching up in front of his face. Scavender stamped his boot on the deck and lunged, letting his hands slide down to the last foot of the haft of his axe. He aimed for the prisoner's stomach, hoping to push him off balance. The prisoner's eyes went wide, and he flailed at the axe head with his bell guard, pushing it down and to the side.
"You do know that Toadsticker has a blade, don't you?" said Scavender.
He pulled his axe back and resumed circling the prisoner.
"Then again, you wouldn't get much experience using blades just taking strawberries to Brendinas."
The prisoner shifted from holding his blade straight up, close to his chest, and extended his arm, the tip of his sword wavering uncertainly. He didn't speak, though his face looked like a mouse cornered by a cat.
"If you're a spy, you probably do have experience with blades," Scavender continued,
as he tested the prisoner by batting at the other man's outstretched sword.
"Just shorter ones." "I told you not to play with your food," said King Bajani, with a smile in his voice. "Finish this."
The prisoner took advantage of the distraction provided by the king's words and rushed the scout captain, swinging his blade wildly. Scavender parried the blows easily, blocking them with the reinforcing strips on the haft of his axe. He swung the head around, twisting it to hit with the flat, not the blade, aiming for the side of the prisoner's skull. Unfortunately, his target was no longer where it had been. The prisoner's head was a foot lower as he cowered from the scout captain's attack. Nud whispered to Einan,
"Are you going to do something before Baldi is killed?"
"Wait," said Einan. Something about the prisoner's movements reminded him of the way his quarterstaff instructor back in the Coombe, a distant cousin, used to play with new students at weekly levy drills. Scavender took one hand off his axe and beckoned to the prisoner.
"Come here, Strawberry," he said. "You'll look good with a thrall's talk around your neck."
As he spoke the last word, Scavender tossed his axe in the air, grabbed the last foot of the haft, and repeated his original attack aimed at the prisoner's stomach. The prisoner beat the axe head down with his bell guard, forced it to the deck with a booted foot, and walked up the haft towards Scavender. The scout captain didn't have good control of his weapon, since he'd only been holding it in one hand. He was staring down at the deck, ready to retrieve his axe, when the prisoner's bell guard caught him under the chin, snapping his jaw shut and knocking him backward. Scavender's head hit the deck and he lay still.
"You talk too much," said the prisoner.
He gave the scout captain a gentle shove with his boot and only got a small moan for his effort. Bending down, he lifted the pullstone on its thong around Scavender's neck and placed it around his own neck. Sigrun and Ranveigir were clapping until Queen Signy gestured to them and they stopped. Nud gave Einan a "What did you know that I didn't know?" look, then stared at the prisoner. The bald young man faced the thrones. "I assume I'm free to go." Behind him, an apple core fell from the top of the mainmast and bounced off Scavender's nose. Chapter 34 Daemon. Daemon waved his hands in front of his face a few more times, then opened a congruency to a high, cold mountain. The resulting difference in air pressure sucked most of the midges out of the conclave's assembly hall.
"Who's in charge of this madhouse?" he said,
amplifying his voice with a transparent, solidified sound megaphone.
"That's what those two were trying to determine," answered Inthira.
"Of all the foolish nonsense to be wasting time doing,"
Daemon began. He stopped abruptly when he realized his subconscious grumbling was loud enough to fill the hall. He took a deep breath and pointed at the two wizards coated in ice.
"Someone thaw them out before they get frostbite."
Three young wizards with painted flying discs strapped to their backs stepped forward. One opened a link to the far south and directed warm sunlight on the combatants. Another connected to a desert's hot winds. The third opened a temporary circular hole below the once dueling mages to ensure the melting water didn't pool on the tile floor of the assembly hall.
Why aren't you already formed into fighting units and joining the Royal Army? Daemon asked in Thera. There's a Biffaland dragonship fleet heading upriver, and the army's already marching down the west bank of the Brenavon to stop them.
We know, shouted a solid-robed wizard with long brown hair and a deep contralto to Daemon's left. That's what Dothan was trying to tell Hiblick, but Hiblick wanted to fight for leadership of the Conclave.
Dothan was one of the people fighting? Asked Daemon. I didn't see who was fighting. I just saw a duel in the middle of the assembly hall and sent a blast of cold to stop them, Daemon muttered softly. Still not realizing, his solidified sound megaphone amplified everything. I would have expected more sense from Dothan.
He didn't want to fight, said Inthira. Hiblick forced the issue, said the wizard with long brown hair.
Unamplified muttering hummed around the hall as the gathered wizards talked about the duel and Aelderman's arrival. In the center of the hall, the ice around Dothan was almost completely melted. The young wizard who'd created the temporary hole to drain water rose on his flying disc and pried Hiblick's fingers off the older wizard's neck. The two descended to the floor, and Dothan held the younger wizard's arm to stay upright with one hand and rubbed his neck with the other.
I'm glad you're not dead, said Daemon, smiling.
So am I, said Dothan. There was nothing to worry about. I had him right where I wanted him.
Dothan grinned, and a wave of laughter sped around the hall. Even some wizards in striped robes joined in.
Sorry I had to freeze you, said Daemon.
Think nothing of it, Master Mage, said Dothan, releasing the young wizard's arm and stepping toward Daemon on the platform. A mug of hot cider will warm me up. I'm glad you're here to lead the Conclave and get us organized. I didn't really want the job.
No one with any sense would, said Daemon.
Said Hiblick, as the last of the ice around him melted and he tumbled to the hard tile floor. The two young wizards, melting his cold coating, had tried to slow his fall, but Hiblick was too big and had too much inertia for them to be successful.
I wonder if either one of them tried very hard, thought Daemon.
More laughter, at Hiblick's expense, filled the hall. The big man got to his knees and shook himself like a dog. Nearby wizards put up shields to save themselves from flying droplets. A few seconds later, Hiblick stood and glared up at Daemon on the platform.
"I'm the kingdom's master mage," said Daemon. "Leading the Conclave has always been a prerogative of that role. Do you want to challenge my right to lead?"
Hiblick stood up straight and squared his shoulders.
"You've been gone for 40 years, old man. What do you know about the kingdom?"
"More than you might think," said Daemon. "And I've probably trained half the wizards in this hall at my academy."
From the tone of the murmurs around the hall, Daemon was right. Hiblick had not been one of the wizards accepted for studying in Melincarrig, however. Few wizards now wearing striped robes had.
"A wizard's duel isn't the only way leadership in the Conclave is determined," Hiblick said. His chin stuck out in challenge. "And it shows your character for you to suggest it when you stop me from earning my rightful position. It's unfair for you to suggest a duel after I'm already tired from defeating Dothan."
"Ha!"
Dothan exclaimed from near the platform.
"There is another way to determine who will lead us," Hiblick continued. "I call for a vote of all wizards present."
Daemon shook his head.
"Are you always this stubborn and opportunistic?"
"Afraid you won't win, old man? Afraid the kingdom's wizards want younger and more vigorous leadership?"
"I'm confident the Conclave will prefer someone who hasn't been swilling potions to increase his strength and aggression," said Daemon.
How dare you level such baseless accusations?"
"What did she tell you they'd do?" said Daemon softly.
Everyone heard what he'd said.
"Enough of this foolishness," said Hiblick.
He raised his arms to encourage his followers.
"I've called for a vote. Do I have a second?"
"I second,"
came a wizard with a long white forked beard in striped robes.
"I second,"
said a short free wizard, wearing shoes with 3-inch wooden soles.
"I second," said Dothan. "The sooner we finish with the vote, the sooner we can join the Royal Army."
"The motion to vote has been made and seconded," said Inthira. "Does anyone other than Elderman and Hiblick wish to stand for leadership?"
She scanned the hall.
"Very well. Vote for Daemon by projecting a circle of tight light on the ceiling to the left of the platform, or for Hiblick by projecting a square to the right." Wizards made their choices and sent their votes up to the domed ceiling to be counted. Daemon added his glowing blue circle and Hiblick his square. The vote was far closer than Daemon expected.
Princess Gwynedd must have offered substantial inducements to a great many free wizards, he thought.
Have you all made your choices? Asked Inthira.
She glanced around the room and saw every wizard's arm raised and many nodding heads.
Very well. Let's see who's won.
After first nodding to Daemon and Hiblick, Inthira commanded the voters to take the next step.
Pair up, she shouted.
Daemon and Hiblick matched theirs first. Circles and squares blurred across the ceiling until each square had a circle inside it. One circle remained unbound by a square. It was Mary's vote.
Who is this? Complained Hiblick. She's not a member of the Conclave. She hasn't been tested.
Furcher trained me, said Mary, amplifying her voice. Let me demonstrate my skill.
She pulled her circle vote down from the ceiling and made it grow until it was a dozen feet across. Moving her fingers faster than Daemon's eyes could follow, she filled the circle with a knotwork net of glowing blue force. Taking a deep breath, Mary shot the net forward, wrapping Hiblick up in its interlaced azure strands and lifting him to the ceiling, where more iridescent blue cables of tight light held him fast.
"Would anyone care to dispute my membership in the Conclave?"
asked Mary in her sweetest voice. The hall was silent, except for Hiblick's protests from overhead.
"The Elderman wins," said Inthira. "What next, Master Mage?"
"We head for a certain inn near the palace," said Daemon. "It has a gate to the village of Arthaban on the west bank. We can link up with the royal army there."
Half the wizards cheered, the ones in solid-coloured robes and a good fraction of the free wizards. The ones in striped robes and the remaining free wizards didn't look happy, but most of them seemed willing to comply. Daemon told Inthira the name of the inn, and she led a procession of wizards out of the assembly hall to walk the few blocks to their interim destination. Soon, Mary, Daemon, Dothan, and Hiblick were the only ones left.
"That was a nice piece of tight light work," said Daemon.
"Thank you, Master Mage," said Mary, making a small bow.
Daemon shook his head and smiled at her.
"You learned a lot from Furcher in a short time," said Dothan.
"You gave me a good start," said Mary, "and Furcher worked me hard."
Hiblick continued to complain above them. Daemon, Dothan, and Mary looked up.
"An excellent spell," said Daemon,
admiring how Mary's net of light grew tighter around Hiblick the more he struggled.
"Are you going to release him?"
asked Dothan.
"You've made your point," said Daemon.
"Neither one of you is any fun," said Mary. "Don't worry, I've put the tight light net on a time delay."
Soon, the construct disappeared, and Hiblick had to scramble to craft a solidified sand sphere to break his fall. He was the only witness to his downfall, however. Daemon, Dothan, and Mary were already gone.
Chapter 35 Tuathal and Vero.
"You're sure this will work?" asked King Tuathal. "We're going to win."
"We're talking about war, brother," said Vero. "There aren't any guarantees, but I'm confident." King and wizard stood on a low hill above a broad marshalling field west of Tamloch's capital. With his palace and the walls of the city behind him, Tuathal reviewed the royal Tamloch army, filling nearly every acre of the wide, flat plain below. Pipers wailed as new forces marched in to ensure the empty spots were filled. There were thousands of foot soldiers with swords, pikes, spears and axes. Ranks of archers, separated into crossbow and longbow corps, were interspersed between squares of infantry. Units of heavy cavalry, barded horses carrying armoured knights, were smaller in number, but took up a disproportionate amount of space. Fast scouts on horseback, mounted infantry and horse archers were in the van. Green banners snapped in the strong breeze off the cool water of Vatakalo Bay. They signified the warrior's duchy, county or barony. Tuathal turned to look at his capital. Ryas was located at the north end of the bay. It was the best harbour in the kingdom and was usually a forest of masts, but now the docks were almost empty. Every ship that could carry supplies had sailed south days ago. A young man with curly red hair and a pointed beard carrying a silver tray, two goblets and a large green glass bottle approached.
"Would you care for refreshment, Your Majesty, Master Mage?" asked the young man.
"Yes, thank you, Sal," said Vero. "I could use some wine. Herding unit commanders is thirsty work."
"Just a half cup for me, boy," said Tuatha. "And for him," the king added, indicating Vero. "I want him to have a clear head."
Sal filled a goblet halfway with red wine.